Hello, welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
We'll be in Isaiah today, and there's a couple of commentaries that I mentioned to you last week. We're going to be in two very, very important passages as far as the Jewish and Christian understanding of the Messiah. And that'll be chapter 9 and chapter 11. Now, there is a brief contextual introduction to both these chapters that we must see. So let's look at chapter 9 first. To get the setting of what's happening in chapter 9, you must look back at chapter 8. Verses 19 through 22 are a radical contrast to chapter 9 itself. You see, what's happening here, and we must understand this to see what the background and the beauty of this. The kingdom split in 922 B.C. Jeroboam, an Ephraimite labor leader, took the northern 10 tribes, and Rehoboam, Solomon's son, had the southern 2. Well, these split empires rocked along for many years. Well, later on, we're around 735 B.C., Syria is a dominant, aggressive puppet state of the world empire of that day in that part of the country, the Tigris-Euphrates River Valley, called the Fertile Crescent, was Assyria. And so Syria wanted to rebel against Assyria. And so it talked the kingdom of Israel into rebelling with her. And they wanted Judah to rebel. But Ahaz would not rebel with Israel and Syria against Assyria. And so Assyria and Israel invade Judah to force her to rebel. So Ahaz, against the warning of Isaiah, writes a letter to the king of Assyria, Tiglath-Pileser, and says, "Come help me." So Tiglath-Pileser invades Syria and northern Israel around 734 to 732, and he devastates this northern area. Now, I want to go to a map for a minute. I hope you'll look in the back of your Bibles, all right? Let's look together. Notice we're talking about the area of Zebulun and Naphtali, and there's those two tribal allocations, the most northern on the western side of Jordan. Now, these were devastated in this Tiglath-Pileser invasion around the 730s, and then finally the empire fell, the northern kingdom fell in 722 completely. So this same devastated area is what now is going to be blessed. And that is why in verse 1 of chapter 9, it mentions the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. Now, it's important for me, when I look at this, to realize that hundreds and hundreds of years before the New Testament time, remember I said this return from the exile, this whole period of Assyria and Babylonian domination takes up the book of Isaiah. Assyria is dealt with in chapters 1 through 39, Babylon, and really the return from exile in 40 through 66. We're taking this local occurrence in the day of Ahaz and Isaiah and using it as a foreshadowing of the ministry of Jesus Christ. We know that because this chapter is quoted in Matthew chapter 4, verses 15 and 16. Now, this is a prediction that Jesus' ministry is going to be around the Sea of Galilee. Now, friends, that is so unpredicted. I want to tell you why. I mean, as far as the people of their day, they expected nothing political, nothing military, nothing economic, and nothing spiritual to come out of that northern mixed Gentile area. The fact that 750 years before Jesus' birth, that his primary area of ministry is going to be shown is a sign of the supernatural nature of the Bible. I've got a tape on the Bible, Can I Trust It?, which deals with the evidence, the intellectual, academic, verifiable evidence for a supernatural Bible. If you'll write for our free catalog, we'll make that tape available to you. Now, so notice it mentions, make glorious by way of the sea on the other side of Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. Now, Galilee of the Gentiles can be translated the circle of the nations. Now, if we're talking about Jesus' day, it's a derogatory statement about the mixed population that occurred during Tiglag-Pileser's invasion. He imported people from Media and exported the Jews, the northern ten tribes. So in Jesus' day, there was this mixed population of Samaritans down south and a whole repopulation of Gentiles in this northern area. The Decapolis is a Gentile area. The Gadarene demoniac, Gentile area. So it may be derogatory, but this little word nations or Gentiles is the word goy, plural goyim. Now, it does refer to Israel in some parts of the Bible. Genesis 12:2, Genesis 18:18, Exodus 19:6, Isaiah 1:4, Israel is called goy. So maybe it's a reference to the people of God, or maybe it's a derogatory reference to the area being Gentile. And we just can't be sure. It depends on what area we're talking about. And it's very confusing for people. Isaiah was writing to a local situation that had much fuller implications in the life of Jesus. Okay? The people who walk in darkness will see a great light. Now, light is often used as a biblical metaphor for truth, salvation, the presence of God, and that's what it is here. Notice it mentions in verse 3 about the joy, the gladness. Glad is gladness, glad and gladness, and rejoice is all those verbs are in that verse 3. Friends, I want to tell you it's God's will for man that we be happy, that we have abundant lives. I want to tell you Christian faith and biblical faith ought to be a rejoicing, happy, wonderful experience with God. Friends, we think the black hat and frowning all the time and keeping a bunch of cultural rules is what Christianity is. I say to you, God wants us to rejoice in His physical creation. Rejoice in our fellowship with Him. Oh, the world ought to come to God just from the joy we have in knowing Him and walking with Him. Quite often they flee from our rules. Now in verse 4, the yoke, the staff and the rod are all symbols of the tyrannical oppression of foreigners in the Promised Land. And it was just a series of them, Assyria, Babylon, Persia, Rome. But they'll come a day when God's going to set them loose. Now, notice in verse 5 where it talks about the battle and the warriors. Well, excuse me, I forgot a little part back in verse 4. Notice it says at the Battle of Midian. Now, the Battle of Midian was basically a battle that occurred in Judges 6 through 8. Now, it's also this northern area that we're talking about, north of the Sea of Galilee. And Gideon was a judge supernaturally empowered to deliver the children of Israel from an outside oppressor, the Midianites. And he totally defeated them. So this is used as a sample of the total victory that God is going to bring in the Messiah on the last day. Now, in verse 5, it mentions the battle, the bloody clothes that are left, the implements of war. And there are two possible interpretations. Number one, that the implements of war, the battle is going to be so victorious that all the military weapons and all the military clothing is going to be burned as domestic fuel in the fires of the people. Or the battlefield is going to be cleansed and purified by fire where all the things are going to be burned. And you might want to see Deuteronomy chapter 13, verses 16 and 17. Now in verse 6 it says, a child be born to us, a son will be given. Notice the human aspect of this political ruler, this ideal leader of God, which we know as the Messiah. Notice he's going to have a normal physical birth as a child. He's going to start out very lowly. And very in obscurity, okay? Now, it lists several titles for him here. This idea of a child links this chapter 9 back to chapter 7, verse 14. And there are a series of four names. Now, it mentions the government shall be upon his shoulders. The metaphor used to describe God's ultimate reign is the metaphor of Oriental monarchies. Jesus talked about the kingdom of God. Now, it is a physical metaphor, but it's all we have to talk about God's complete universal reign and control. When Jesus said, "Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven," he was praying for the kingdom of God to come. And here, the Messiah is depicted as an ideal earthly ruler. Now, here are these names, and I think there are four of them. The first one is Wonderful Counselor. Now, basically, this is an emphasis on the administrative ability of this ideal political ruler. Now, the word wonderful can have many translations. It can be awesome. It can be marvelous. It can be unknown because it's too far beyond man. You ought to see Genesis 18:14, Judges 13:18, and Isaiah 29:14 for different uses of this word wonderful. The idea about a wonderful counselor is mentioned again in Isaiah 28:29. So it means his administrative ability. Now the second term, mighty God. Now this has two very important connotations. Primarily, the literal here is God of a warrior. And basically we're emphasizing the military victory of God's ruler, that he's going to overcome all military foes. But because it's mighty God, there's an implication here of his deity. The same title is used for God in chapter 10, verse 21. Now there is a tension here between the humanness of the child and the title of deity. But that's the same tension between Jesus Christ being fully God and fully man. We see that also several times in the Bible. This same ambiguity of deity and humanity is in Daniel 7:14. It's also the idea of deity is mentioned in Jeremiah 32:18. The Jews were not expecting God incarnate. They were expecting a supernaturally empowered man. But there were hints, even in the Old Testament, that it would be God incarnate, or deity himself. They're vague hints, but they are there. Now, the third title, Eternal Father. Literally, this means the Father of Eternity. And there are two aspects here. Primarily, it's the emphasis on the parental nature of God, the guardian nature, the providing nature of God. But also involved is the ideal of the duration of his reign, forever and ever. And so both are involved. And then final, the title is the Prince of Peace, which is an emphasis on the quality of the reign of this ideal servant of God. Now, verse 7, there will be no end to the increase of his government or of his peace. Now, really, this 7a is a summary of the four titles just mentioned. Okay, then it continues. On the throne of David and over his kingdom. We've got to go back to 2 Samuel chapter 7, where this is mentioned. Or we might go to Isaiah 11, verse 1, we're going to cover next in the same lesson. So it's this tension between the divinic king and a perpetual kingship. Now we know there's some tension here, because this kingdom is eternal, not temporal. And yet David's kingdom has passed into a state of shambles, a godless condition. Well, you might want to see Daniel 7:14, Luke 1:38, Hebrews 1:8 and 12:28, 2 Peter 1:11, and Revelation 11:15 for the fact that the kingdom that God's going to set up in this ideal ruler is going to be eternal. Now, I don't know what your millennial position is, but there is a tension within the biblical witness between that thousand-year reign of Revelation 20, which is temporal, and the eternal reign that God's going to set up. Now, I don't know which one of those you pick, but I assure you there's got to be some balance between both of those without bending certain scriptures. Now, it continues then when it says, to establish it and uphold it. Here is that administrative ability. He's going to have the wisdom to start it and the power and wisdom to implement it and then sustain it. With justice and righteousness, this is the ethical aspect of God's nature that is so evident in this ideal ruler. Then finally it says, the zeal of the Lord of hosts, which means the captain of the army of heaven. Have you sang that hymn by Martin Luther lately, A Mighty Fortress Is Our God? A little phrase that says, Lord Sabaoth, his name. Well, that's the Hebrew term for the captain of the armies of heaven. Now, let's turn then, if we could, to Isaiah chapter 11. Now, we must remember that in Isaiah 11, again, we must see the literary context. If you'll look at chapter 10, verses 33 and 34, this mighty Assyrian empire has been brought low. And the metaphor used is a vast forest that has been cut down. Nothing but stumps remain. And so the author is thinking about these cut down trees, all this huge series of stumps, but he says, you know, there's one stump, the stump of Jesse. There's going to be hope. And so in chapter 11, we find that. A shoot will spring from the stem of Jesse. Now, the word shoot is also used of the Messiah in Isaiah 53:2. Now, it's used in the New Testament in a rather peculiar way. The Hebrew word for shoot or sprout is pronounced similarly to the word Nazareth or Nazarene. And a very funny little passage in Matthew 2:23, it seems that this passage is the only one that could possibly fit in the Old Testament for the author saying that the prophet said that Jesus would be a Nazarene. Now, exactly how that fits, I must say, is pretty ambiguous. Now, when it mentions here from the stem of Jesse, this is the idea of a stump, and it's going back to Jesse from 2 Samuel chapter 7. Many have said, why Jesse, not David? Well, I think Jesse, because probably his family was still in Bethlehem. They lived a more simple life, not like the opulence and corruption of the Davidic palace. And that's probably why it's Jesse and not David. Now, let me mention to you, it says, a branch from his roots will bear fruit. An inconspicuous descendant of David is going to be an effective leader for God's purpose. You ought to see Revelation chapter 5, verse 5, where Jesus is said, from the root of David. Very important promise. And in verse 2, it says, the Spirit of the Lord will rest on him. Now, many have tried to relate this Spirit of the Lord passage in verse 2 to the seven spirits of Revelation 1, 4. But there really aren't seven spirits, and it really doesn't fit at all. And I think it's forcing the Bible to try to say that. What we have here is a series of the gifts that God's Spirit gives men to equip them to do what God has called them to do. And Messiah has several of them. I think there's six of them, really. Six of them because he is uniquely or ideally equipped as God's complete and full representative. Now, the Spirit of the Lord will rest upon him as emphasis on the abiding nature of God's Spirit. It's going to stay on him. Now, there's a lot of cliches out about the Spirit before Pentecost and the Spirit after Pentecost. We need to be careful of making things so simple we try to put it in little boxes. But I think the idea of the Spirit's going to come and rest on the Messiah is implied here. He will delight in the fear of the Lord. Now, the word will delight is really in Hebrew the word breathe in. It's the idea of smelling. It's the olfactory sense. The rabbis take this verse as a proof text that the Messiah will be able to judge men by smell, not by sight or hearing. Now, that sounds rather strange to us. What is the background to this? Well, I think the background probably is the sacrificial system where the smoke rose up and God was pleased. Or maybe it's the incense altar where that sweet-smelling aroma is a symbol of God, the prayers of God's people fill the temple. Something of that is probably the background for this breathed in. Notice it says, and he will not judge by what his eyes see, nor make a decision by what his ears hear. You know, Jesus was profoundly able to look at men's hearts. He didn't judge by their words. He knew their hearts. He didn't rely on any human resources. It was divine, intuitive knowledge. You ought to see John chapter 2, verse 25, and John chapter 7, verse 24, for a beautiful example of this in the life of Christ. Now, then it says, but with righteousness he will judge the poor. Two are things here. First of all, the word righteousness, the etymology of that Hebrew word, means a measuring reed. We would call it a ruler. And the standard by which we judge all things is the person of God himself. That's why all the Hebrew words for sin mean deviation from a standard, being crooked. Now, the standard is God himself. So righteousness is that holiness that God incorporates in himself. Now, when it says he will judge the poor, it is a characteristic of Messiah that he's going to be fair. He is the head jurist as the king of Israel, the leader of Israel. You might want to see Leviticus 19:15. If the poor are treated fair, everybody will be treated fair. Then it says, he will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth. Now, it may sound funny to you, God judging the earth for the sins of men, but that is a biblical doctrine. Back in Genesis chapter 3, all of creation fell because of man's sin. The classical passage on this is Romans chapter 8, verses 19 through 26, about that creation suffers because of man's sins, but creation will also participate in man's redemption. And I think verses 6 through 9 depict that, and I want to amplify that further when I get to verse 6. Now, the little phrase, the rod of his mouth or the breath of his lips. There are two things here. We must remember the significant thought about the power of the spoken word in Hebrew. It had an independent force all of itself. Isaiah 55, 11, 8 through 11 is a good example. Genesis 1, God spoke and there was creation by fiat, by the spoken word. Now, that may be the power here of the spoken word. I'm not sure. I know it's a pronouncement of judgment here and justice. Some say it's related to Revelation 1:16 and 2:16 about Jesus having the two-edged sword out of his mouth. That may be true. I just don't know the exact background, but that's probably related. Now, notice it where it says in verse 5, also righteousness will be the belt around his loins and faithfulness a belt about his waist. A common biblical metaphor is clothing used as a symbol for moral or spiritual characteristics. A good New Testament example that uses this very same thing would be Ephesians chapter 6, verse 14. Notice that this is the ascription of an ideal ruler, and righteousness is the girdle that holds everything else in place. Faithfulness is the unique characteristic of God, which is depicted in this ideal servant or ruler's life. Now, verses 6 through 9 is a beautiful picture about nature being restored. I don't think that we're going to heaven. I really think that heaven is coming to us. Now, I know that when we die, to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord, 2 Corinthians 5:8. But I also know Revelation 20 and 21, 21 and 22 talks about New Jerusalem coming down out of heaven as a God, I mean, as a bride, I'll get it in a minute, prepared for a husband. Now, basically, I think that's what's going to happen. The Bible begins in Genesis 1 with God and man in a garden setting with nature and animals. The Bible ends in Revelation 21 and 22 with man and God's fellowship restored in a garden setting. I believe Isaiah 11 adds to that. I believe we're going to have a recreated earth world where righteousness will dwell, God and man will be together in a nature setting. Romans 8, 19 through 26 is a classical passage. I'm not saying your parakeet's going to be there, but I'm saying I think animals will be there. It'll be a part of our fellowship with God, is our complete fellowship with ourselves, with our fellow human beings, and with the animal kingdom that we've longed for but never known. And I think that's part. And notice it talks about that there will be no more carnivorous animals. And notice, again, the mention about a little child. A little child's mentioned in verse 6, it mentioned in verse 8 twice. Now, I do not know exactly how the child in verses 6 and 8 is related to the aspect of the child being the political leader from Isaiah 7:14 and 9:1. But it's obvious that God is using the symbol of a child in many ways. The inconspicuous beginnings of the Messiah and the restored earth. It's a little child that's going to lead them. And that seems to be the idea of the combination here. Notice in verse 9 where it says, and they will not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain. Now, basically, what this holy mountain is, there's some difference of opinion among commentators. Some think it means Mount Sinai or Mount Jerusalem, you know, the city of Jerusalem, Mount Moriah, the temple more particularly. I really think because of the context, because of the second part of this verse, it refers to the whole world. It's like the kingdom of heaven has come and totally encompassed the kingdom of men. And so my mountain refers, I think, symbolically to all of the earth. Now, the reason I think it's so beautiful is, in the second verse of chapter 9 it says, for the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord. Now, here again is the whole earth being spoken of. I also think that those unique characteristics of the Messiah that are so well embodied and fulfilled by him are now the characteristics of all men. God tried to deal with all men in Noah, and it wasn't working. So God picked one man, Abraham, to pick one nation, to be a kingdom of priests, to win all the world. But even that one nation didn't work out well. So I think God picked Jesus Christ as the ideal Israelite, the ideal human, to focus back into all men. So here we have the ideal Israelite passing on to all men the characteristics of God. And I think that's exactly what New Testament is talking about when it talks about we need to be Christ-like. And this is the Old Testament background for that, I do believe. Isaiah chapter 7, 9, and 11 is so very important for our understanding of who Jesus Christ really is. Many have said that Jesus is not really of Davidic line, that it was Joseph, and they weren't really physically related. We're not sure of the exact lineage of Mary. She seems to be related to the tribe of Levi, but where in her background she may have had Davidic blood, we just don't know. But for Jews, the illegal thing came through Joseph, and he is fully of the line of David. So here we have in Jesus of Nazareth, whose ministry was in Galilee, a prediction that goes hundreds of years back. There's no way Jesus could fulfill being born in Bethlehem before he was born. And so we see the Bible, that supernatural prophetic book, hundreds of years before the actual date, coming to depict not only his lineage, but in Micah chapter 5, verse 2, the very town he would be born. Isaiah 9 talks about the humble beginnings. Isaiah 11:9 talks about his primary focus of ministry, which is the area of Galilee. Isaiah 7 talks about the virgin birth. When you put all these together, it's absolutely astonishing of how much we do know about the life of Jesus 700 years before he was born. Friends, I believe in a supernatural book. And I believe the very fact that we celebrate Christmas in our so secular culture says something of the permeating effect that Jesus of Nazareth, a poor carpenter who never wrote a book and never traveled more than 100 miles from his house, has had on the kingdom of men. I don't think you can explain that away any way than a supernatural influence. Well, I've really enjoyed being with you, and I want to mention to you that we have a seminar where we have really tried to help people study the Bible for themselves. All of the exegetical stuff that I do and the outlines I provide, you could do if you had the right resource tools and were trained to do it. I think a meaningful thing to start the new year might be a commitment to study the Bible itself and not what you think it says or what you've always been told it says. This seminar is available on 3 90-minute cassette tapes and a complete notebook for $19.95. If you would like that, if you'll write me, I'll send it to you. If you like it, you can keep it. If not, you can mail it back. I think it'd really be a blessing for you as you try to study the Bible for yourself. And the area of predictive prophecy is so difficult, but so rewarding. I think it'll be a blessing to you. Please pray for me in the upcoming new year. I've enjoyed being with you in 1983 and look forward to seeing you next week. God bless you. I've enjoyed being with you.